Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck of katelovingschenck.com and the author of the Prayer Prescription Series. The Prayer Prescription Series is the sponsor of this show. My guest this evening is Linda Graham, MFT, author of Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. The book brings brain science to the subject of resilience and how we can heal and be strengthened by very imaginative exercises included in the book designed to rewire our brain for a resilient life. Joining me now is Linda Graham. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Kate. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So you train other therapists how to apply neuroscience in their work. Is that correct?
I do. I teach other clinicians and I teach my own clients, and I've found that people are actually very excited to learn how their brain works. It gives them a sense of competence and confidence in making the changes they want.
Well, how can they contact you online?
My web address is lindagraham-m as in Mary, F as in Frank, T as in Tom, .net.
And you spell Graham. Tell them how you spell Graham.
I'm sorry. So it's LINDA GRAHAM.
Great. I will put this into the chat room as well.
Thank you.
Now, Linda, what are the 5 C's of resilience, resilient coping, and how can we all use those 5 to work? I would say, how can we get them all to work simultaneously?
Well, there actually is a trajectory going through the 5 C's. First, we come into a state of calm because we have to have a calm nervous system, a baseline of equilibrium so that the higher brain stays online and we're able to make wise choices. I've actually added a 6th C since the book went to the printer, which is compassion, especially self-compassion. We have to be able to notice that we're having a moment of suffering, that we're having a moment of, ouch, this hurts, and be able to offer ourselves some tender, caring, kindness, caregiving, so that, again, we can bring our brain back into calm. That leads to clarity, where we can actually see what's happening, see our reactions to what's happening, begin to discern some options. We step back from the event of the moment and we discern some options and we can choose wisely. That will lead to connections to resources, whether those are inner psychological resources or the outer resources to other people, to use places and practices as our resources so that we're not coping alone. We're nourished and replenished. Then that will lead to a sense of competence, sure I can do this, and a sense of courage. And one of the exercises I offer in the book is to do one scary thing a day, which retrains the brain to get through our natural hesitancy to do something new and actually move into new behaviors, new territory.
Now, it would seem to me that something, one scary thing a day wouldn't have to be terrifying, would it? It would just be mildly scary.
Well, actually, what happens in the body brain is that any time our brain notices we're about to do something new, it doesn't even have to be scary or risky, just something new. There's an automatic somatic reaction in the body. Uh-oh, I've never seen this before. Don't know if I should be doing this. And we experience that as a hesitancy, a stopping. And it's important to be able to continue going forward. What's happening in the brain is the dopamine circuit, the neurotransmitter of dopamine, is a neurotransmitter of pleasure and reward. And when we do something again and again and again that gives us a sense of pleasure and reward, the dopamine is flowing. When we sense, uh-oh, this is new, I don't know if I should be doing this, the dopamine stops. And that's how we begin to get an anxious feeling in the body. So we train ourselves to do one scary thing a day so that we train our brain to get across that threshold, do something, feel competent, and get the dopamine going again.
Well, that's a very good practice, I think, and it wouldn't even take very much time. It would be something that can be just incorporated into our daily schedule for sure.
That's right.
Now, how does mindfulness meditation and meditation in general create new neurons in the brain and help us to cope more creatively with life challenges?
So the neuroscientists discovered just in the last 10 or 12 years that, in fact, the brain has neuroplasticity. That simply means the brain can grow new neurons and create new connections among those neurons lifelong. So the brain is not a fixed structure. We use self-directed neuroplasticity to create the kinds of experiences that will cause the brain to fire in certain ways or cause certain structures to fire in certain ways, so that we're actually strengthening the structures of resilience. So in the book, I've said that two of the most powerful agents of brain change we have are mindfulness and resonant empathic relationships. Those are two ways we have of creating the most immediate and long-lasting changes in the brain. So when we practice mindfulness meditation, we're actually strengthening the structures in the brain that we use for resilience. When we are in empathic resonant relationships, we're strengthening the structures of the brain that we use for resilience. The key structure is the prefrontal cortex, which is the most evolutionarily advanced of all of our brain structures, and it also takes the longest time in an individual human life to mature. It's not fully developed until we're about 25 years of age. So the practices of mindfulness and being in healthy, empathic, resonant relationships strengthens the functioning of the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex does so much to help us be resilient that I actually call it the CEO of resilience. It's the executive functioning center of the brain. And when it's working well, then we are working well.
Well, it just comes to mind that by practicing what you lay out in the book, that we don't have to fear or have the false belief, as it were, that as we age, that the brain declines. It would not. It would seem that if we are practicing resilience and practicing strengthening the brain to be to direct our resilient lives, that we don't that the brain just continues to evolve.
Well, the neuroscientists actually are getting very fascinated with this because there's such a large baby boomer aging population coming along. So it's true that the natural process in the brain will be to atrophy neurons as we don't use them. The way to keep a brain alive and vital and healthy and functioning well, which includes keeping our memory functioning well, is to require it, to require the brain to learn something new. That's how we keep it healthy. If we don't do that, the brain will just kind of get tired and wear out. But if we choose, it's like going to exercise at the gym. If we choose to require our brain to work a little bit, it will stay more alive and healthy. So that's why the brain fitness experts are constantly advising people to learn to speak a foreign language, to learn to play a musical instrument, to learn to juggle, which requires the brain to integrate many different structures.
Right.
One of the things that is the most fascinating to me is that if we do cardiovascular exercise, anything that makes the body break a sweat, of course we're getting more oxygen to the brain, which is good for the brain health, and we're releasing endorphins, the feel-good hormones, so that we feel better. But we're also requiring the brain to release what's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes the brain grow new neurons. So simply by doing your half-hour or hour-long run every day, you're helping to keep your brain healthy, not just your heart, but your brain healthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we are a holistic organism, and nothing really does operate separate from any other part of the body or the, you know, the organs or anything like that. So that would make perfect sense.
Exactly right, yeah.
Now, how does mindful empathy rewire our brain?
Because mindfulness and empathy both will strengthen the structures that we need to use. For instance, it strengthens the anterior cingulate cortex, which is what we use to focus attention. It strengthens the insula, which is what we use to pay attention to what is going on in our body. It strengthens the corpus callosum, which is a thin band of fibers that unites the two hemispheres of the brain, the right and left hemisphere. So it functions to integrate our feeling with our thinking and our social-emotional self with our analytical cognitive abilities. So when we strengthen these structures, the brain itself is more integrated and more able to process information. In addition, since we know that the brain is a social organ, the brain develops initially only in interactions with other people, eventually always the best in interactions with other people. When we're in relationships with other healthy brains, the interaction actually influences the brain growth. It actually kindles the brain growth and helps us learn not only the content of better coping strategies, better ways of living in the world, but strengthening the structures of the brain we need to do the rewiring. So it's mostly practices that help the brain itself stay healthy and vital and functioning well.
Well, I was just envisioning the brain, you know, how we always imagine the brain is just sort of tucked away in the head, and but what you're describing is that the brain reaches out to other brains and communicates that way. I just imagine that. It sounds very interesting.
Well, Dan Siegel at UCLA, who's one of my mentors, has created a field called interpersonal neurobiology, and it is the study of how brains interact and brains communicate and brains influence each other, so that we're moving away from the idea of the brain being a single skull phenomenon, and that actually, as we're interacting with other people, our own brain is getting enriched and developing.
It's like an extraterrestrial in our own head or something.
Well, what happens is the brain extends into the body as well. The entire nervous system is part of the brain.
Yeah.
And because we pick up signals from other people through our body, through the lower brain and then processed by the higher brain, we're constantly picking up signals of whether we're safe or dangerous in our environment, and especially in our people environment. And that can happen very swiftly, very unconsciously. But you can walk into a room of people and get a sense whether this feels like a friendly, safe environment or whether it feels hostile and angry and antagonistic. And that all happens in the brain even without coming to conscious awareness or conscious processing. We evolved as social beings. The human being survives only by being raised in a family, in a tribe, in a clan. And so everything about our brain has been shaped by human development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How is attunement a higher form of empathy?
How is what? Attunement?
Attunement.
Okay, so in the book I talk about a resonant circuit moving up from the brain stem of the brain, a five-part resonant circuit. So the lower level is resonance. That is picking up the vibe of other people without even conscious processing, and that happens in the brain stem. When you move up through the midbrain, where you're starting to get the emotional meaning of interactions or interactions with the environment, then we're beginning to attune to what we're feeling, what the other person is feeling. One of the most remarkable things about attunement is primarily nonverbal, that they've discovered that the emotional meaning is communicated between people, I hope I get these numbers right, 55% by facial expression and body language, 38% by voice tone and prosody, and only 7% by words. So attunement is primarily a nonverbal sensing what the other person is feeling or sensing what we're feeling. Then that will move into empathy, which is a cognitive process. Empathy is a conscious making sense of our experience, our own experience or somebody else's experience. It creates the narrative and it makes sense of the story. And the empathy requires that that meaning is conveyed to the other person and it lands with the other person. So it creates this felt sense of feeling seen and heard and understood and accepted. Then the next step of that resonant circuit I have is compassion, where we have not only understanding but compassion for the experience, ours or somebody else's. And that's especially important in resilience, because resilience is coping with stress or distress or trauma. And when we can have compassion, this is one of the more exciting discoveries by neuroscience also. When people are practicing compassion, the functioning of the brain shifts to the left hemisphere of the brain. There's more neural activity lighting up in the left hemisphere of the brain. The reason that's important is the right hemisphere of the brain carries forward the negativity bias of the brain. We're evolutionarily hardwired to pay more attention to negative experience and intense experience than we are to positive or subtle experience. That's for our survival. But the right hemisphere carries forward that bias, so the right hemisphere has more of a withdraw or avoid stance toward experience. The left hemisphere, which actually develops a little bit later in the brain, has more of a sense of approach or openness to experience. So when we practice compassion, we're activating the functioning of the brain where we can have more of an approach stance toward our experience, which is very important if we're trying to understand it and not avoid it or not run away or not shut down. And then the last step of that resonance circuit is acceptance, particularly self-acceptance, because self-acceptance is so crucial to resilience, to be able to accept ourselves, love ourselves, appreciate ourselves, not get hijacked by the inner critic, not get shut down by a lot of judgment or shame, but to be able to stay open to the goodness of our own nature, of our own being. And that's a tremendous resource for resilience.
Yes, it would seem like a good sense of humor would go a long way to bring all of this, to accelerate these processes.
Right. The scientists have discovered, they call laughter not an emotion. They call it a physiological mechanism. It's what the body does to reset the nervous system. When we laugh, we're changing our physiological state. And they have found that a good 5 minutes of laughter will create a sense of calm and relaxation in the body that will last for 45 minutes. So laughter is actually a way human beings have to kind of come back to their own sense of center and perspective. It's also a tremendous bonding mechanism. When people can laugh together, they share humor, they share a joke. When they can laugh together, there's a sense of connection that's very different than when we feel isolated and separate from other people. And that sense of connection is also a tremendous resource for being resilient. We need to know that we're not alone, help is available, we're all in this boat together, to have the courage to keep coping as we need to cope.
Yeah, you had mentioned in your book, too, that self-compassion is more effective in recovering our resilience than self-esteem. I think that would be something that would our audience would be interested in, too.
Right. Now, this is based on the research of Kristen Neff, who's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and she's really one of the leading forces behind the entire self-compassion movement in the country right now. And she discovered that self-esteem works. Self-esteem works to help us feel good about ourselves as long as things are going well. Because self-esteem is based on achievement and accomplishment and comparison. Whereas self-compassion works all the time. It especially works when things are falling apart and when we feel more fragile or more vulnerable. Because self-compassion is just based on caring that some kind of hurt or harm is happening. It's not about being good or feeling good. It's just that we're a human being that's going through a moment of suffering. So self-compassion actually calms down the nervous system. It activates the oxytocin, which is the natural hormone of safety and trust and of bonding and connection. Whereas self-esteem operates more on the dopamine circuit, that circuit of pleasure and reward. So dopamine will work anytime pleasure and reward is going on. But self-compassion works anytime we simply need to activate the caregiving system and take care of ourselves.
Wow, that's a very interesting comparison between those two words, you know, or the meanings of those two words. So thank you for that. That's great. So how does self-awareness, self-reflection, self-compassion, and self-acceptance unlock the potential of our wise, all-knowing selves?
Oh, well, that's a big question, isn't it? I'll say the self-awareness actually works kind of in two ways. So self-awareness, when we pause, take a moment to notice the experience that we're having, notice our reaction to the experience that we're having. When we can notice and name our experience, it keeps the higher brain online. It keeps the prefrontal cortex functioning, and we need that to be able to make good decisions. So we notice and name our experience so we're not swirling around embroiled in it. We actually get to step back a moment and reflect. So when we step back and reflect, we begin to see that there are different perspectives, there are different options. I'm feeling this way right now, but I wasn't feeling this way 10 minutes ago or yesterday, and chances are I won't be feeling this way tomorrow, especially if I can take wise action. So the self-awareness or the self-reflection allows us to step back and get perspective. Once we have perspective and can shift our perspective, then we can begin to see that there are options. We can make different choices, and we can choose the experiences that will help us rewire our brain for the better. Now, all of that involves what they call the self-referential mode of processing in the brain. It's all the midline structures that pay attention to our experience in the moment. The other way that mindfulness practice or expanding to a larger awareness helps us be resilient is there's another mode of processing in the brain, and I call it the defocusing mode of processing. Mm-hmm. When people can experience this, when they're relaxing like in a daydream or a reverie, they're just kind of walking along the beach. When we relax the grip of worry or tension or focus on ourselves, and we simply allow our awareness to expand out to a more spacious awareness, then we actually create a kind of looser connecting in the brain. We're able to create the conditions where new insight, new epiphanies, new ahas can just pop up out of the blue. the material is always there in our brains, but we're able to make new connections in new ways. We connect the dots in a new way. Oh, that's something I never thought of before. So that's another way that the capacity to be aware of the larger perspective also helps us then come back and change our patterns and be more resilient. So the mindfulness works in both of those modalities of processing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it seems like the mindfulness goes all the way through that whole process.
Exactly. You know, mindfulness as it came to the West, and there's controversy about teaching anything that is religious in the public schools. So it is taught as attention training. And mindfulness practice is attention training. And the students who learn how to do it even 15 minutes a day, you know, their grades go up and there's less violence and bullying in the schools, et cetera. It's marvelous. But mindfulness comes from a tradition that is meant to take us all the way to enlightenment. And so besides training our attention, we're also training our capacity to rest in this larger awareness where we can see the flow of life, the flow of experience, and experience our own inner goodness, which is always there.
And by simultaneously being self-aware and self-reflective, and that this kind of unlocks the wise self. So you're seeing a larger perspective as you are also being self-directed, or as you are concentrating on yourself. You are also simultaneously realizing that there's a larger world out there.
Right. I wrote the book originally. One of the big impetuses for writing the book was I had to reconcile being a psychotherapist and helping my patients develop a healthy, resilient sense of self, which we need to navigate in this world, and then also being a practitioner of Vipassana meditation, where we learn and practice letting go of the self. And I had to reconcile those two things because they come from different paradigms that have a very different perspective on truth and on the nature of reality. And it was the neuroscience that helped me find that bridge. So what I came to finally in one of the later chapters of the book, I think it was chapter 19, The Wisdom of Simply Being, is I just drew a model for myself of my grandmother gave me those nesting dolls, the Russian nesting dolls, one smaller doll is inside a larger doll, inside a larger doll. So I see five kind of layers to this sense of self. And the first is the inner child, you know, the early experiences that we have that might leave us sometimes in a state of fear or self-doubt or unworthiness or whatever. There's the adult self, which really holds that inner child and does its best to navigate the world as best as we can as adults and do what it can to heal the wounding of that inner child. The next layer is the wiser self. This is really our higher self, which is sort of our own personal flavor of all the good qualities and virtues and characteristics of a wise self, where we're generous and compassionate and clear-seeing and patient and persevering. The wiser self is simply our personal reflection of essential, universal, true nature, that that every being has this essential goodness. And that is held in a larger consciousness that is described as the isness or suchness of being. There's no form. It's just what every form arises out of. And so I have those five layers, and we can know at any moment which layer of self we're in. And we can choose to use the experiences that will help change the automatic patterns of the earlier layers. So I have exercises in the book to cultivate a sense of that wiser self, that it's actually our own intuitive wisdom. It's just listening to our own deep inner knowing and deep inner wisdom.
Yeah, so it seems to be very wise to be in that all-wise knowing self as much as we can. Because,
right, exactly.
Yes, yes. You have talked about self-directed neuroplasticity to identify habitual negative reactions. So that you said to use words to break certain patterns that we may have developed in our, say, our knee-jerk reactions to what people may say or the way people act, that may go straight to childhood, to, by the way our parents treated us, et cetera, but we can break this pattern. Can you talk a little bit more about that? That's fascinating to me.
Right. So in the first and second chapters of the book, I talk about how what conditioning is in the brain, how the brain learns these patterns in the first place. And it's simply that now the neuroscientists know any experience at all, will cause neurons in the brain to fire. If we repeat those experiences, we'll cause the brain to fire in similar ways again and again over time. With repeated experiences and repeated neural firings, the brain begins to establish actual circuits and pathways in the brain, making it more and more likely that we'll respond in the same way to the same stimulus as we did before. This is how the brain learns, and this is it's excellent that this happens. We learn a lot of automatic conditioned habits so that we don't have to consciously think all the time. Most people eventually will drive from their home to work on automatic pilot, and they don't even really have to think that much about how they're doing that until something different or unusual happens. The problem is the conditioning, it can go positive or negative if we're around people who have healthy, flexible, resilient ways of coping. We're going to learn those strategies. But if we're around people who cope with life more by running away from it or by being angry, then we're going to learn those habits of coping, whether that's our conscious choice or not. That's going to be embedded in our deeply implicit unconscious memory. As we become adults and we want to rewire those patterns, we learn because otherwise they will be our default. If we're not consciously thinking about something, we're going to do it the automatic way we've learned how to do it.
Mm-hmm,
so the
mm-hmm.
self-directed neuroplasticity is making a conscious choice to be aware and to use the experiences. That's why I have like 80 exercises in the book, to use the experiences that will rewire the brain in a more positive direction. And I break that down into three ways. There is new conditioning. Okay, so we come into this world and we grow up and our brain patterns are already conditioned. There's new conditioning where we simply learn something new and create a new pattern in the brain, and that can become a new habit that lives side by side or even overrides the old habits. But even more powerful is what I call reconditioning, where now the scientists have seen this only in the last 5 to 7 years in their scanners. If we have a negative memory, problematic, even traumatic memory, and we're able to pair it with a positive, more resilient memory or experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if that positive experience is more powerful, it's stronger, when we pair them together, the neurons holding these memories together will fall apart and then rewire again. They call it deconsolidation, reconsolidation. So when we choose to use that, we deliberately use a positive memory to not only override or antidote, but to rewire the old memory. What happens is the new memory then becomes the new neural circuitry, and the old circuitry is gone. This is the basis of all trauma therapy. This is how people are actually able to heal from trauma so that they're no longer triggered.
Called simultaneous dual awareness.
That's right. You have to be able to hold, or at least go back and forth very quickly, but to hold the negative memory and the positive memory in this simultaneous dual awareness so that when the neurons fall apart and rewire together, they actually will rewire together and the positive will trump the negative.
Mm-hmm. How does forgiveness rewire the brain?
Well, forgiveness is really a practice of coming out of the contraction, the fear response, the anger response, where the lower brain is dominating our behavior, and reopening the brain to a more open, spacious way of being and learning. Now, that simply creates the conditions, sort of primes the brain with the conditions so that we can then learn new behavior. So forgiveness practice is a practice to open the heart and the mind, but the brain as well, to a new way of looking at things or a new way of being or a new way of learning. It's essential because when we're contracted, defended, when we're walled up, we're not learning anything. Those defenses preclude learning and nothing new is going to happen. So forgiveness practice is a way simply to open us up to learning from new experiences again.
And as you said, it is essential. It is not something that you can just say, well, I can do everything else and not forgiveness. You have to do forgiveness.
Well, any place where we're contracted, we're going to shut down learning. It's just simply that simple. And so when we're contracted in anger, hatred, bitterness, we're not going to learn anything in that particular situation. So forgiveness practice is simply a way to relax the grip of that contracting and opening up to a learning space again. They will call it a mental play space. We're just creating room for the brain to learn something new.
I love all the different examples you give to release oxytocin so that we can get back to a state of calm. And I don't think I realized how important oxytocin really is. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Right. I'm really sort of on a campaign to make oxytocin as much a household word as adrenaline, because when we go into an alarm response, the brain will release cortisol, and that's the stress hormone. It's to get us moving. It's to get us to take action, fight, flight, or freeze. But the natural antidote to the stress hormone cortisol is oxytocin. It is the neurotransmitter, it's natural in the brain, of safety and trust, of bonding and attachment, of calm and connect. So when we can activate the release of oxytocin, it is the direct and immediate antidote to cortisol. The blood pressure lowers immediately, and we can come back into a sense of calm immediately. Now, oxytocin is released primarily through warm touch and through loving, safe relationships. And so the exercise that I have in the book on hand and the heart is being able to use the warm touch of your own hand on your own heart to begin to activate the release of oxytocin and calm the nervous system down. When you deeply breathe, gently slow deep breaths into the heart center, that activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the calming branch, and begins to calm the body down. When you breathe into your heart center positive emotions, kindness, goodness, safety, love, delight, that will also restore the heart rate variability of the heart to a calmer sense. And then you begin to remember a moment of being loved, of being safe and cherished with someone. I mean, of course, you can go to someone for a hug or a pat on the back or a hand on the shoulder, but even remembering in our imagination will help release the oxytocin that calms the body down. That exercise, hand on the heart, can calm down a panic attack in 1 minute. So oxytocin is a very powerful hormone in the brain, and we use it to bring ourselves back to that baseline of calm so we can be resilient.
So the one, the hand on the heart, but then the other hand on the lower abdomen so you can sense your diaphragmatic breathing is another part of that, I would think.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And they found out that not only can oxytocin calm down a stress response once it has started to happen, but when someone has the oxytocin flowing, if they're already in a state of physiological being, of remembering being loved or being with someone they love, that will preempt the stress response. The body just simply doesn't go into the same stress reaction when the oxytocin is flowing. So the more that we can cultivate safe, comforting, loving relationships, the more resourced we are to cope with stress and to not even feel the stress.
And rubbing the head is another way to release oxytocin. And also rubbing the base of the skull that meets the neck.
Right, so warm touch will help release oxytocin. You can put your hand on your cheek and say, oh, sweetheart. You can give yourself a hug, even in a business meeting. Stan Tackin at UCLA found that a 20-second full-body hug, that's about 3 breaths, is enough to activate the release of oxytocin. When you're massaging the base of your skull, that's where the vagus nerve comes into the skull, and it's loaded with oxytocin receptors. So you're actually stimulating the release of oxytocin when you do that. And again, you can just do that in a business meeting. It just looks like you're having a little neck rub. So there's lots of ways to keep the oxytocin flowing as we go throughout our day, and that increases the sense of well-being, and it actually becomes a buffer against the sense of stress.
And, of course, there's nothing like breastfeeding.
That's right. Breastfeeding, orgasm, all of those are very good for oxytocin, right?
I do. I work at a natural birth center so that we don't use any drugs. And then the mothers all, I haven't seen any of the mothers not breastfeed. And there's just such a wonderful, that calm that you're describing. Nothing can really interrupt that calm that the mother and the baby have together. It's just so beautiful.
Right.
Absolutely
lovely. To remember that mechanism is evoking a sense of calm. It is also evoking the sense of attachment, that oxytocin is the hormone of attachment. So when a mother and newborn are breastfeeding, it's just an intravenous feeding of attachment, and that's where the bonding begins to happen. Right.
I'm going to have to tell them that, because instead of just talking about bonding, it's what you just said, intravenous form of attachment. That's really great. Now, we've come to the end of our time together. I really enjoyed this thoroughly.
And I have too. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And I just want to, again, mention your website, which does it have to be www?
Yes.
www.lindagraham, G-R-A-H-A-M. -mft.net.
Yes.
So everybody go over there and take a look. And is this your only book so far?
This is my first book of this caliber, but the website has the newsletters that I've been archiving for the last 5 years with much of the information that has wound up in the book.
And we can sign up on your newsletter.
Right.
And I would just recommend that you make a workbook out of this beautiful book of yours.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I think it would be very helpful for all of us. And have a wonderful evening, Linda. Thank you for giving us some time out of your day to do this. And namaste.
Namaste, Kate.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.